Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
Okay, welcome to Cosmic Eye. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have, as usual with me, my co-host, Chris Sheridan. And we're excited today because we're talking about Chris's book, The Spirit in the Sky, A Fall of Icarus, The Rise of Phoenix, and Odyssey of the Soul, a memoir. That's a mouthful. That's a great title.
Yes.
All right, I am going to read the back because I love the copy that's on the back of this book. So I'll just start with that, and then we'll get into speaking a little bit about your book, and you can introduce yourself and so forth. So after surviving a plane crash and adjusting to life in a wheelchair, Chris Sheridan never revealed what exactly happened in the cockpit that day until now. Follow along on an epic journey of ups and downs, twists and turns, still coming full circle and face to face with the spirit in the sky. It took 25 seconds to fall from the sky and 25 years to figure out why. Great stuff. All right. So Chris, please introduce yourself and a little bit about the book and tell people where they can find it and so forth. And we will get started.
Oh, sounds good. All right. I am Chris Sheridan, as you said. And about 27 years ago, I was involved in a plane crash. I was a pilot. I was flying at an air show and I crashed, and in between the time I called a mate on the radio and the plane hit the ground, I had really an incredible spiritual experience that I've been reluctant to talk about all this time. And writing this book is sort of my way of revealing and releasing what I've kept hidden for so long. Now, the crash left me in a wheelchair, so I've been talking about the plane crash for this whole time. And I had made a short film years ago about it, a personal documentary. And I talk about one aspect of the spiritual experience and encounter that I had. But for the most part, I've kept that pretty much to myself. And this book is about that.
Well, you talk about actually that short film that you made in the book a little bit. And I've seen it, and it's fantastic. Why don't you tell the listeners who might not be familiar a little bit about that project? It's a fantastic check out, even. It's a great film.
Okay, yeah, it was called Walk This Way, and I made it in 97. So this was about between 5 and 6 years after the time that I broke my back. So I had, you know, plenty of time to recover, you know, physically. I was adjusted to being in a wheelchair and socially. And it was a look back, maybe, or just how I got to this point from the crash, the point at which I had made the movie then. And it was a student film, but it really also had a life in the film festival circuit. Won a number of awards at the Heartland Film Festival and the Sedona Film Festival. And it also won a Student Academy Award in 1997. So it got a lot of attention, and it is up on YouTube. It might be easier to get the link to it from my website, chrissheridan.com. And it was a direct link to the video of the 16mm film. But that was one sort of telling of my story.
Okay.
It's a short 12-minute film. And then now I have a 200-page book that carries up until and through the point to where I made that film, but also what's happened in, say, the 20 plus years since I made Walk This Way.
That's great. And having read the book and seen your film, they're both fantastic. They both work together really well. They tell about different aspects, I think, of your journey in ways, and that's nice. They're complementary. The book is interesting because I think one of the themes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the themes that I got out of it is that it was difficult for you to be able to share this experience with people for various reasons. And I think that that's kind of one of the themes that you kind of keep going back to in the film is how, excuse me, not the film, in the book, of how you struggled with that vision. And even more, you struggled with that vision and sharing what happened to you inside the plane probably more than you struggled with your actual disability. Would you say that that's true?
Well, it is, and it's on...
In some ways. I mean, yes, I don't want to grossly simplify, but...
But in a way, it is that simple that at least the full account, all the details, exactly what happened in the plane was so fantastic, so otherworldly. It wasn't an out-of-body experience. I was very much in my body. It wasn't a near-death experience. I was nowhere near death. I was fully alive. It was more opposite. I would almost compare it to... say like an alien abduction case or something like that, where there's really good reason for you not to talk about it because it's not very believable. But sure. I also never really had the chance to, because first of all, you know, surviving any kind of major trauma and being able to continue living is quite an amazing story. Ask anybody in a wheelchair who survived a spinal cord injury. I'm sure they have a tale of survival. Every single one of them. And also when I would answer the question, well, what happened? Was it a motorcycle, a car crash? You know what? I said, well, you know, it was a plane crash. And they're like, oh, plane crash. Oh, and you lived. I'm like, God, that's great. So yeah, it's like, that's already amazing.
That's the party winner, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fantastic enough. So why would I gild a lily? You know, why would I try to embellish, even if it's true and it is, what happened? There just wasn't any room for it or time for it. And
sure.
And I felt it was a very personal thing. And in the film, I talked about, you know, like I said, one aspect of it where I heard a voice. And I've shared that, you know, certainly with the film and on other levels, but, in one sense, it was very personal to me. So I didn't, really feel like I needed to share it, or maybe in sharing it, I might kind of lessen the personal effect that was almost a private thing. But really what's driven my reluctance has been the actual content of the experience. Like what was the vision that I saw? What were the words directing me towards? What was this vision of my future that I also saw in the sky in the plane crash? And that has been not only hard for me to share with other people, it's been for the longest time very difficult for me to accept just personally. I accepted the fact that I was in a wheelchair. I mean, I kind of have to, because it's so overt and so physical, yeah, and so obvious.
There's no getting away from that one, is there?
We can't really hide it. I mean, you could hide out and just spend, you know, your time online and never, you know, no one would ever know you're in a wheelchair or something. That's fine too. But if that's the case, but it was something that I just really just had a hard time wrapping my head around, because it was a direct message given to me about my life. And it wasn't the message I wanted. It was, certainly at the time it wasn't, but
Let me stop you quickly, because I want to cover the vision, you know, in more detail a little bit down the line when we speak. But let's get back to the idea of how you've kind of repressed this part of yourself, and how you know, it's taken you so long to reveal this. Let me ask you this, then: why now? And how were you able to finish this book now? And what changed for you that that made it possible for you to finish this great book and to share it with people so that they can find some lessons in it for themselves as well?
Well, I think it was just time. I had waited long enough. And in my, I guess, defense, if I will, when I made Walk This Way 22 years ago, it was... that was the telling of my story. I had actually, for a long time after that, felt that, oh, I had already told my story. Look, here's the film. Because that was my story up until that point. Not all of it, but that, you know, covered the crash and the injury and adjusting to life in a wheelchair and using humor to cope and things like that. But as time went on, I knew there was more to it. And I was getting further away from the film. And it's like, okay, if, And I just didn't want to be a one-trick pony. I didn't want to be, oh, that's the guy in the wheelchair who broke his back in a plane crash. Like, that's, I didn't want that to define me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't
know. I understand.
Ability, and I put myself out there in the world. As a matter of fact, for decades, most of the time I would go to a place and I would be the only person in a wheelchair. 95% of the time, unless it was a public event like a concert or car race, you know, or something where there's a mm-hmm. handicapped seating area.
Sure.
For the most part, it was just, I was always the odd man out, but I thought I was putting myself out there in the world, being the guy in the wheelchair and not afraid to, you know, handle social interactions or going out or traveling or flying or whatever it is that I'm doing. I've always sort of been that example. So I've very easily been willing to share myself and answer any question. I'm very open if people don't feel comfortable asking something and they're like hesitating. Oh yeah, go ahead. You can ask, or hey, I'll make it easy for you. You don't break the ice.
Yeah.
But I also didn't want that. I wasn't envisioning myself as like a disability advocate and, you know, yes, I'm in a wheelchair and I'm all about wheelchairs and all about people that are in wheelchairs. Although I have done advocacy and outreach and counseling and things like that since, mm-hmm. I felt my life would be more just out there in the world. And I would be, whether it's a filmmaker or a rock musician, which I am, or a scholar or something, function, a father, a husband, you know, who happens to be in a wheelchair. I always wanted.
So you didn't want to be you wanted to kind of lead by example, not by necessarily your words and your platform. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, I didn't want it to be all about the wheelchair because my life isn't all about the wheelchair.
Sure.
Yes, I'm in a wheelchair every day, and you know, most of my waking hours, unless I'm driving or sitting on a couch, I'm in my wheelchair, and it's been that way for over 25 years. But that's not what my life is about. It has nothing to do with personal relationships or, you know, what kind of food I like or what my career ambitions are. You know, I play guitar in rock bands. I've played before I hurt my back, and I've played since, and it's, I have to go about it in a little different way, but you know, I still play.
But you don't want it to define who you are person entirely. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that definitely speaks volumes.
Well, it can be a novelty, and actually about maybe it was 4 years after my injury, Christopher Reeve got injured, and mm-hmm. he really dominated headlines. There really didn't need to be a wheelchair guy in the news, because he was on, you know, Barbara Walters, he was on Dateline, he was on, you know, just, I don't know if you remember at the time, I mean, you know, it was a while back. But
no, I do remember that.
It was
exactly.
The consciousness was flooded with, you know, spinal cord injury and wheelchair. And
yeah, it was huge in the news at the time. I do remember that.
He was carrying the banner, so I felt that, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't need to do that.
Sure. So timing has a lot to do with how we want to present the different things. That makes sense. Not to cut you off, but I want to jump into this really quickly before we get into the vision and so on, so that the listener has a kind of an understanding of what actually occurred. Can you just briefly outline, you know, what happened before not the vision, but how the crash took place, what you were involved with, you know, at the air show and so forth, and kind of explain that a little bit, just very briefly.
Sure. I was a relatively young pilot, young in experience at the time. Almost 27 years old. I'd been flying a couple years. Most of that time was spent getting my license and, you know, the flight trainings. I'd kind of had to spread it out over time, but I was getting more hours and flying different planes. And this was a ribbon cutting contest at an air show. And the air show was for planes and pilots of a specific type, and that's a Burt Rutan designed long easy. There's some variants, but they're home-built aircraft. They're very high performance. They're made with a foam core covered in fiberglass or carbon fiber nowadays, mm-hmm. Kind of like a surfboard. So they're very light and very strong, very aerodynamic compared to a general aviation plane like a Cessna or a Piper.
Yeah.
So sporty.
So
and
sort of like
efficient.
A Corvette in a sense of the flying world.
Sure, definitely more performance and and you know, that type of excitement.
Okay.
They're sport planes, they, you know, for sure. And so this group of, you know, like pilots and their planes all flew into an airport in Utah, in a place called Kanab. And there were a few contests that morning. There was a air race, so I guess full on total speed, your absolute speed. And then there was a spot landing contest where you land on the runway as close as you can to the numbers on, painted on the runway. And the third one was a ribbon cutting contest, which the one I was involved with.
Okay.
And basically what happens is from another plane, a streamer is dropped out at a certain altitude at 3,000 feet. And as it unfurls and makes its way down in this vertical streamer, like a ribbon, you have between 3,000 feet and when it reaches 1,000 feet above the ground, it's called the hard deck. That's a safety cutoff. You basically make passes at it and hit it with your wing. Now, it was made out of toilet paper, of all things, which okay. Is absurd when you think about it, but it also made sense because, sure. You know, same length for everybody because everybody goes one at a time and each pilot gets their own ribbon to cut.
All right, so that
so it's that's identically
pretty
matched.
Dangerous, if I'm not mistaken. I am no pilot, but it sounds yeah. like you're a young pilot. You're in a very maneuverable, experimental, quote unquote, plane, and you're trying mm-hmm. to fly around and cut toilet paper flying through the air. I'm hearing a bit of danger in that, and which brings me to where you say, title of your book, A Fall of Icarus. I'm highlighting that, and Icarus, for people who don't know, is who now? He's the Greek.
Well, in mythology, Icarus and his father Daedalus were imprisoned in a labyrinth maze on an island, and there was no way for them to get out. But Daedalus was an inventor, and he fashioned a set of wings for him and his son, both made out of wax and feathers. So the feathers were attached to this wing contraption with wax. And they worked, and they were able to leave, and they were able to escape and kind of basically fly out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But Daedalus warned his son before taking off, said, if you fly too low, the spray and mist from the sea will make the feathers all soggy, and, you know, it'll be too heavy, and you won't be able to fly, and you'll crash. Or if you fly too high, the sun, you'll be too close to the sun, and the sun will melt the wax, and then the feathers will fall off, and that'll be a problem too. So,
okay.
So they escaped and they left, but Icarus did not heed the warning of his father, and he flew as high as he could. He was caught up in the ecstasy of flight and crashed to his death below. So I make that parallel because I also did not heed the warnings and follow the rules of flight. Flying is a unique thing in itself because most other things, the faster you run and the higher you climb, it actually becomes more dangerous if you're running, you know, or if mm-hmm. you're climbing a
yeah.
tree.
Yeah.
Faster and higher usually equates more danger. But in flying, it's kind of the opposite. If you have airspeed and say something goes wrong with your engine, well, then you can pull up and you can trade that airspeed for altitude.
Yeah.
You can just climb up and then you can have more time to look down and try to find a suitable place to make a landing or fix the problem or whatever it is. So airspeed is your friend. You can trade it for altitude. And I was going not too low, but I was definitely going too slow.
Okay.
And that caused, there was a couple other things that were kind of going wrong at the same time. And they all conspired to put the plane in a deep stall condition that is
okay.
very difficult to do in this type of a plane. But if yeah. you do, it's very difficult to get out of. And
so,
that's where I found myself.
Yeah. And you go into great detail of how all that takes place or took place in the book. And it's very, very fascinating. The thing I want to kind of jump ahead to, because I don't want to spend too much time on the details of all that, because it is fascinating stuff, but it's something that I think is better read in the book. And I want to leave it to the listeners to get your book and read it, those sections on that. But one of the important things I think that
that you talked about and we were talking about earlier is the acceptance of that vision. And I mean, what led up to that vision too, one of the things that that really stuck out for me was the point at which you called Mayday, and you talk a great deal about that in the book. Can you explain a little bit about how that happened and what that Mayday meant to you?
Well, I tried everything I could to get out of the deep stall condition. Once I kind of realized what it was, I tried this, I tried that. And it's like, oh my gosh, now I'm in a deep stall. That's what it is. There is a recovery procedure. I didn't have the altitude and I tried to use it, but I knew it wasn't going to work. So it was really at that moment of realization that I am going to crash a plane. There's nothing I'm going to be able to do about it. And then instinctively, I guess, my training kicked in and I keyed the mic for the distress call. You're supposed to say Mayday three times. It's very specific why you do that. And usually it's when nothing else is, it's like, here I am, come find me.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to give your location and everything. I didn't need that. I was in inertia right over the airport. People were watching. But I did need to call it Mayday, and I didn't realize it at the moment, but it, years later, it came to me several times that, oh my gosh, that was a complete and total surrender. It was waving the white flag. It was an admission, and it was over the radio. It was vocal, so I spoke it out into the ether, and somebody else on the other end of the mic heard it. So it was very definitive.
Well, spiritually,
I am Mayday. I'm done.
Yeah, and we've talked about this many times, and I like the sort of spiritual metaphor of that. In that, oftentimes we get overwhelmed in life with things. Say we're addicted, or we're, you know, in a terrible abusive relationship, or whatever problem we're dealing with in our lives, that we sometimes can't heal until we actually do surrender and call that Mayday. And you've brought that up to me many times. And I think that's a great point. And, you know, monumental way that you experienced that, applicable to people that are listening, in that, you know, in their lives, they might have things that feel greater than their capacity to deal with, like you had in the plane crash. And that surrender is an important thing. It's that acceptance, isn't it, that helps the healing. Would you agree?
Well, it is. And it's also an admission of our own limitations. There's something very human and very humbling about it, that on my own willpower and with my own resources, I am unable to solve this problem. That's basically what a surrender does. And what that does is open you up to anything and everything else that's not you trying to solve this problem. It says, okay, I can't do this on my own. And it sounds like it's a defeat, but it is so empowering because it brings in these other forces. And we know this from, you know, religion. Of course, a lot of, even the word Islam means to surrender to the will of Allah, the will of God. Mm-hmm. Surrender your personal will to God's will, not my will, but thine be done. We've heard that. There's in the program of addiction recovery, that's the very first step of the 12 steps, admitting you're powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable. Sounds really defeatist, but it is not. I have an example from my brother, who was a longtime scuba diver and would take people out swimming with dolphins and sea creatures and everything in the Bahamas. And he had a diver panic on him. This diver came to the surface, and I wrote about it in the book. He's flashing, he's splashing, mm-hmm. and trying to, you know, he's going to drown them both. My brother didn't know what to do. So finally, as a last resort, he grabbed this panicked diver by the neck and punched him in the face. And it stopped. They stunned him. And it stopped him long enough.
Shouldn't, but it is. It's that's crazy.
But that's this. It brings up another point.
Yeah.
So anyway, my brother's able to inflate his vest, his buoyancy vest, and save both their lives.
It caused him to have to surrender to being saved. He needed to wake up and allow that to happen, didn't he?
But he wasn't. Yeah, because he wasn't allowing it.
So he was fighting it. He was fighting it.
How often do we stubbornly hold on to this notion that, nope, I've got this, I should do this? nope, I'm going to figure this out. Well, I don't want to ask for help. You know, it's...
No, that's a great point.
It's a phenomenon that we all go with.
We all struggle with that.
There's pride involved or...
The ego gets involved, right? I mean, it's all those things we want to solve it ourselves. And it's interesting, but I think it's so significant that you know, once you finally surrender and you do call the Mayday, it's after that point that you have the vision. And now we can really kind of get into that, because I wanted to set that up first for the listeners so they could understand the context of where this was headed. And I want to just read the quote, because I love your quotes. You have great quotes throughout the book, and you have this one from William Blake from his poem Heaven and Hell. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. That's, of course, where the Doors got their name, by the way, and I'm a big Doors fan. But that sets up the chapters to follow where you talk about the vision. So let's get into that a bit and just kind of give me an overview. You know, we don't have to get into every single detail, but an overview of the vision, and we'll just talk about some of the bigger points in it, and you can share, you know, what those mean to you and so forth. So go ahead with that.
Okay, well, it all began immediately after I called the Mayday on the radio. And at that time, I really believed I was going to die. I had no sense or, you know, possible notion that I was going to survive this. I mean, I thought it was certain death. But as soon as I finished the Mayday call, I noticed the cockpit just became, all the dials and all the instruments started pulling themselves off the instrument panel and were expanding, and there were these dials and gauges and numbers and calibrating graphs and just this whole series of phenomena just around me. And I was surrounded by this clockwork of coordinates, and I felt like I was going somewhere, but I couldn't see where, because it was completely clouding my vision, almost like when you're flying inside a cloud or something. I couldn't really see outside the airplane. All I saw were these grid lines, and I was going somewhere. And then they all stopped. And at that point, the void, the milky void, cleared. And I was out in outer space, and I could see infinity. I could see the galaxy. It was in the shape of a galaxy, in the form of, but it wasn't just a galaxy. It was everything. And there was this infinity loop in a river of fire that represented time. And I knew intuitively right away that, oh my God, this is the space-time continuum, something I'd read about in science and science fiction. It's been a thing. And I have a astronomical and sort of mechanical mind in some ways that I think helped maybe influence my vision. I got one that spoke within a language that I was familiar with. But there were no angels, or, you know, there wasn't a tunnel or a light, or it was nothing at all like that. This was incredibly intense, and I felt like I was really there. Like I really saw this thing, and it was the totality of life and everything that had ever happened or will happen in the future was all happening at once, right in this eternal now. It was amazing. Yeah.
Can I read a quick paragraph that I really, really enjoy from the book?
Sure.
On page 30, I marked this out, and I just want to give the listener a kind of sense of the writing book, because I love your writing. I could see that the total universe, the entirety of eternity, was composed of these individual points of light. They were not only the contents of infinity, but also the framework that held everything together as an indivisible unit. These tiny dots, these lifelines of humanity, were completely interconnected by a thin glowing thread. Each and every one of them was absolutely necessary for the composition of the infinite. Remove a single one and the whole structure would collapse and cease to exist. And it sounds like what you're talking about there is like the Buddhist concept of interconnected reality or interconnected existence in a sense. That's a beautiful,
yes,
beautiful
or a
paragraph.
Yes,
a total unity.
You know, all is one. One is
all.
Yeah,
and that every single...
And the interconnectedness is...
Yeah, just a beautiful way
I've read
that.
About that in scriptures and spiritual texts. And,
but you
know,
saw
hear
it.
About it. We're all one. Yeah. But I saw it and I felt it. I mean, I had an experience of it that was as real as any other experience I've had.
When you get,
but that,
you
know, has been profound.
Yeah, and it's, you know what I like about it too is that, you know, I think what you're breaking down is the barriers and the kind of the differences, and it gets down to our universal essence as human beings. It's, you know, beyond color, beyond race, beyond gender, beyond this, beyond that. And you have that great Rumi quote in there where you say Christian, where Rumi says, Christian, Jew, Muslim, Shaman, Zoroastrian, stone, ground, mountain, river, each has a secret way of being with the mystery, unique and not to be judged. That's the totality that you experienced, it sounds like.
It is. And it was presented to me in this particular form. Maybe somebody else could have gotten the same thing out of a completely different vision or experience, but this is
the one that,
that
you
I
got.
Had.
Yeah.
And this paradox of having there be billions of these separate points of light, you know, these stars in the galaxy that was representing, really aren't separate. Every single one of them connected to each other and completely interdependent. But at the same time, there still is an identity of each single one. And I was able to even see my particular space-time coordinate, my little dot of a lifeline.
Very cool.
In that, so it's kind of a paradox that it's unity and we're all one and we're all together. And at the same time, we're all uniquely individual, but never separate. So there's a distinction, but not, you know, a distant or disconnect.
Yeah. that's a great point. You know, I think it's, I think back to Maharishi's example of that when he talks about in Science of Being, Art of Living, I think it's called, where he talks about the absolute and the relative. You know, the relative is the kind of world, the day-to-day, the differences and so on. And the absolute is that universal that's below the surface of everything that holds it all together. And it's an interesting way to look at things. And, it, you know, it's kind of like the relationship between, you know, Newtonian physics and quantum physics. Like, yes, there is a world we live in where there are all these differences and seeming objects and all of these different things and people and places and so on. But then beneath it, when you break it all down to its essence, it's all just energy or a universal spirit, right?
Right. And we have to balance both of them in our everyday worlds. We kind of have to see things separately or it'll just be a big mush.
Yeah, exactly.
But if we get too cut off from other people and other forces, again, like calling a mayday, we're really selling ourselves short of what is out there. If it's just what you can see, think, and feel, there is so much more. There are so many more forces, human and otherwise, that are available. But it is like, say, with quantum physics and nuclear Newtonian physics, when I'm driving on the freeway, I want all these objects to be separate. I don't want them to connect.
I'm going to do all I can not to separation. Yes, exactly.
But I want them all flowing in harmony, you know, with the freeway, and we're all looking out for each other. We're all going in the same direction. So there's, you know, at some point, one becomes more important than the other. But I just think in our personal lives, if especially emotionally and spiritually, if deep down inside we feel lost or alone or disconnected, that can be very dangerous. And by being in this aloneness, in some odd way, you're actually closer to, because you can feel alone in a crowd, but if you're really alone by yourself, whether it's out in the woods or even just in your room late at night, in some strange sense, you're actually closer to it, because all the noise and all the influences and conditioning of the world really aren't hammering at you like they do most of the time when we're awake, even asleep, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That, you know, we lose touch with that, but that's the best way to get in touch with it. Say if it's daytime and you light a match or something, you know, no one's going to see it. The sun's out. It's so bright. But if it's pitch black and somebody lights a match, it's going to be, whoa, it's a bright light, you know? So
yeah, exactly. And it's
and I think
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, even in, the biblical scriptures, I think there's a point where in the New Testament, Jesus goes out into the desert to be alone. And that's where he has some of these visions and connections, tempting with the devil and, you know, with God and everything else. Sometimes that aloneness actually can be a catalyst for that connection to something beyond yourself, and a way to just feel worse about yourself.
Exactly. And we've been talking about that in the last podcast, and we've been talking quite a bit about meditation with Manly Hall's work, Meditation Disciplines and Personal Integration. We have two parts that we examined in our last podcast, and I definitely recommend people go back and listen to those. That's a lot like meditation. You go into that deep silence to find your greater self, and to try to get yourself in tune with that absolute part of yourself, not the relative and changeable part, but the universal and eternal part of yourself. And I think that's what maybe you experienced in that vision. It sounds like that you saw through some of the relative to the universal, to the eternal aspects of life. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I would say so. And that experience of just seeing the space-time continuum, totality, infinity in front of me, and feeling my, not just seeing, but feeling my part in it, has been with me the whole time. It's part of the vision I haven't really talked about too much, because it kind of needs a lot of context, and it I don't know if that would help any, but I think the few times that I have shared it and some feedback I've gotten from the book is that can be comforting for somebody, knowing that, oh my gosh, I had an experience with this interconnectivity.
Yeah.
Every single point of light in the universe. And we all need each other, and we need each other connected, and we need each other's lights to be turned on, for this whole thing to work.
Some people have
found that comforting.
Huge thing. Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, like we aren't alone. Almost like if, you know, proof of extraterrestrial, you know, visitors or something, that, oh my gosh, we're not alone in the universe.
Yeah, exactly.
But we're not separate from each other.
And yeah, that's huge.
There's no missing out.
I got a lot of value out of that from reading the book. And in your, you do need to read the book to get the whole context of it. And obviously it goes much deeper into the vision than we're able to go into in our 45 or 50 minutes here. But I think that gives the listener a little bit of flavor of what you experienced. I want to encourage them to pick up your book, The Spirit in the Sky, because it's an important book, and it's a very, very helpful book, even though, you know, you tell the story in a pretty matter of fact way. The way that you lay it out is very helpful. And you're right. For me, it points out like these things of that maybe I'm struggling with in my own life, for example, that I have trouble accepting about myself or whatever, or if I'm feeling lonely and not a part of the totality and stuff. It kind of reminds you of those things. And I think that is one of the benefits that it will offer the readers, to help them find acceptance for parts of themselves that they might not accept. And you talk about that in the book, and that really quick. We are. That it's more difficult for the people who are in analysis with him to accept the gold, accept the beautiful parts of themselves, than it was for them to accept the bad parts of themselves. They're much, you know, more cognizant and will readily accept these negative qualities than they will the genius that they have within. And you actually use that, one of the quotes from Jung in your book, talking about that. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the quote, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's something to the effect that people will go to any length, no matter how absurd, to avoid facing their own souls.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Exactly.
And I think that's, that's part of it, is we don't know who we are. I think either we've lost sight of that, the world is too overbearing with distractions and all these things to be concerned with, maybe as a race, as a species, as a culture, a global culture, we've really forgotten what it means to be human. that we have, that we are so, first of all, we're not all that, you know, some people think, oh yeah, and this and all that. And like, no, we're not all that great. So there's a humility to being a human being.
Yeah.
Get over yourself. But the other side of that is we are so much more.
Yeah. It's an interesting paradox.
Even if you are all that in the world, that's not all that important. There's so much more to it than that. And I think that if we can, you know, and again, like you're saying, in meditation, quiet moments, alone, out in nature, if we can, in quiet, not only just the world around us, but our own head and the thoughts and the voices and everything rattling around in there.
Sure.
Just long enough, I think we get this window to the infinite. And
so maybe connect. What you're saying is maybe we don't have to crash in a plane to have that experience, hopefully.
Right.
Is that safe to say?
Well, sure. There are lots of ways to surrender. Okay. Exactly. There are lots of ways to kind of get yourself out of the way so you can see and have a sense really that there's much more there. And maybe these things that are so troubling in the world aren't that troubling. I think we've all, if we've gone past high school years, we survived that long and have enough time to kind of look back on that. We can remember how, for a lot of us, I felt this in some ways myself, but I saw it in other people to a greater degree, is that those, at that time, those years were so important. If it's your first love, if it's this, if it's, oh my God, everything's so dramatic and, you know, your life is over if this didn't happen or, you know, you're so, because that's the world you know. And by the time you're 18 and a senior in high school, you've spent 12 plus years in the public school system.
Sure, exactly.
You're a long time veteran at that point.
It all seems
the culmination, the pinnacle. And it is. And we, but once you get past that, then you think, oh, well, that was back in high school. But at that time, that was because that was your world. You didn't live in the world outside of that so much.
Exactly,
you weren't voting and, you know, legally drinking and, you know, doing all these other things, raising families or whatnot, at least most of us. So I think we can learn from our own lives that, well, gosh, maybe that was. So if we can take that analogy and say, well, what's going on in my life right now? Oh my God, I'm in midlife and I've got this and I don't have that and I've got bills and student loans and, you know, how am I going to think, okay, well, maybe I'm just in high school again and maybe there is a world outside of this one or beyond it, outside, but beyond it. And even our own personal power and our resources and what's available to us to use practically, I mean, practically and effectively, not some, oh, well, you know, the love of God will be with us all throughout our days. That's nice. And I believe that to be true.
Sure.
But how about something that actually, how's that going to put food on the table? How's that?
Sure. There definitely needs to be a balance. And I think that's one good thing that the book does is that, you know, it lays out, you know, this kind of huge, visionary experiences, but then you also talk a lot about just your day-to-day struggles and stuff and how you overcame some of those challenges and so on. And it's all, like I said, it's all in a very matter of fact way that you write it, but it's very inspiring. And I know you don't necessarily like that word inspire, but unfortunately I'm going to have to put that more inspiring to me and to most of the people that meet you. So thank you for that. And thank you for this book. It's a fantastic book, and I highly, highly recommend that you purchase a copy if you are listening, The Spirit in the Sky. It is fantastic. So just quickly wrapping up, because we are almost out of time, how do you think that this book might help others, and how would you like it to affect them? I mean, real briefly, like a soundbite-y kind of thing so that we can give somebody a takeaway. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Let me set this up and I'll give you your soundbite.
Okay.
The book does cover, over 25 years. I mean, it's not my life story because I had, 27 years before the book started.
Exactly.
Of living. And I'm sure there's another memoir or two in there. But it does cover a lot of time and ground. But what the central theme I believe, that I felt, you know, as I was writing it, and now that I had a chance to look back on it, is that, well, and there's even that quote, I guess I could quote that, that's in the book, from the Gospel of Thomas. If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. That's attributed to Jesus from the Gospel of Thomas, Nag Hammadi, lost gospel from the Dead Sea Scrolls that was discovered in the late 40s. And it's, I think that is kind of what it is for me. I've kept this secret, and sometimes they're good secrets, sometimes they're bad secrets. But you're right that people have a tendency to sometimes deny, you know, the good stuff more than the bad stuff. And
true. I kind of shove this down in. Yeah.
And even if it is, quote, bad stuff, you know, there's gold in there too. Where's the oil? It's in the dirt and the muck deep in the, I mean, even oil's dirty. Or even the gold. I mean, the gold and the diamonds are deep in
there. They all have to be dangerous and dug out. And
there's a lot of work to be done.
Sure.
To get these things. So we have a lot of gold. It just needs to be refined, needs to be recovered. I don't mean covered over again. I mean uncovered and brought back out into the light. And that's what's happened with me. You know, that's been part of my journey is, yes, I've shared about the plane crash and the wheelchair for years, for decades, but I've kept that very intense spiritual experience that I had from the world and from myself. But you can't do that forever. It rises up, and I just could not go another year without revealing it, even if people think, wow, that's too fantastic, or wow, it sounds like a made-up story, or you're just hallucinating because you're in a trauma crisis situation or whatever. And I don't really care, but because I know what I know. But it's not doing me any good keeping it inside. So for anyone and everyone else that has, you know, a dream or an experience, and a lot of times it can be coded in a quote bad experience. It can have that wrapping, but if you unwrap it, there's really a gift inside for other people if you share it.
Gold.
But it's definitely with you, within you, and that's the inner divinity or the infinite within that we all have. That we all have that connection to the infinite within each and every one of us, and if we just calm our lives and our minds down long enough to actually hear that voice and get in tune with it and then bring that out. So this notion of enlightenment and seeking, yes, there's a world out there of things to discover, but there's also a world inside. And I think if we look there more often, we might find some really fantastic stuff.
Beautiful, beautiful way to put it and very concisely put. Thank you. Thank you again, Chris, for sharing, and thank you for having the guts to share your vision and your experience, and thank you for pushing through to finish this great book. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, thank you for saying so and giving me this platform to talk about it.
You got it.
I do want to get it out there, and after all these years of keeping it inside, now it's time to get it out.
Exactly, and here it is. People can find more about you at chrissheridan.com. We talked a little bit about meditation and going within and so forth. I have a book called If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, and that's available at cosmiceye.org, cosmiceye.org. And you can pick up my book there and Chris's book at chrissheridan.com, as I said. Thank you again for sharing, Chris. And
All right. And
we look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thanks for listening, everyone, to Cosmic Eye, and we'll be here next Sunday with some new great stuff, and tune in for that. Have a great week, and God bless.
Thank you for listening, and please join us next Sunday for a new episode of Cosmic Eye. You can purchase If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate at Amazon.com or through our website, cosmiceye.org.